You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the U.S. Surgeon General just issued a report on drug addiction. We'll look at the root causes of opioid drug abuse.
First, the State Department of Public Instruction submitted its funding request for the 2017 to 2019 state budget.
The department is asking for an increase of over $700 million in funding for public schools throughout the state, spread over the next 2 years to bolster school services and narrow the achievement gap.
Tony Evers joins us now. He's the Wisconsin State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Superintendent Evers, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate it.
A big picture, a substantial funding increase. Make the case for that.
Well, certainly our schools of the state have been hampered to a great extent by low increases over the last couple of biennium. In fact, two bienniums ago, it was actually reduced. And in addition, a lot of that money went directly into property tax relief. We're all in favor of that, of course, but the most of the money that has been allocated did not go to schools. So it's $700 million, but it's a inflationary rate in the first year and about 5% the second year. So even though it's a big number percentage-wise, I think, doable.
In the news last week, we saw some school referenda around the state, a goodly number of them. You have pointed to that as a sign that this funding is needed.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you think about it. In a relatively robust and a presidential election where people were describing their angst and their anger about government and bad feelings about themselves as citizens, they turned around 55 school districts in the state of Wisconsin and said, we will tax ourselves more in order to make sure that our schools are good places for kids to learn, make sure that we can keep the doors open. And so I think, you know, hats off to the school board members and teachers and administrators across the state. They've connected with their local population saying, we need this, and they understand. Now, in turn, while we're doing backflips around making sure about these referenda passing, that is, to me, that strength is a points to the weakness at the state level. We need to make sure that we reengage at the state level to provide adequate resources so that districts don't have to go to referendum at the rate they are. It's just an amazing number of referenda over the last several years, frankly.
Let's dig into some of the particulars of your funding request. A lot of focus, and we've talked about this some in the past, on schools in rural areas. Can you talk about some of the challenges they're facing, how you're hoping to help meet those in this budget?
Yes, well, we're going to go for a much fuller and robust request around sparsity aid, which goes to our most needy rural school districts. And on top of that request, we're also looking to add some money so that rural school districts can actually compete in a more equitable way for teachers as they look to move on to more wealthy school districts. I think it's really important that our rural schools have the same quality of teachers as our suburban schools. In addition, we'll be looking for resources around high-cost transportation, which is always a significant issue for our rural schools. So all told, we're very proud of what we're doing in our rural areas of the state, but we have to make sure that we continue to provide adequate resources for them.
Talking to Tony Evers, Superintendent of Wisconsin's Department of Public Instruction. You've also looked for more equity in school funding and, of course, equity in school outcomes. How are you trying to address that in the budget?
Well, we're trying to do it in a couple ways. One is our fair funding proposal, which we've talked about several times over the past several biennia, and we're going to come back at it. It's something we all believe in, and frankly, the school districts of the state believe that whatever money is allocated, it's not allocated in an equitable way. We have to make sure that equity is at the basis of our funding system. The Supreme Court has talked about that in the past, and we have to think about making sure that kids that need an extra lift because of poverty or because of their English learners, we need more resources for them. So we're going to be looking at several of the general funding categories to make sure that we have equity as the basis of that.
A special education funding, I know, is another priority. That is a category. Where are there shortfalls? What do you think needs to change?
Well, the categorical aid for special education hasn't increased much or at all over the last couple of biennia. And so we're trying to double down on that and increase it at a reasonable way. It's not percentage-wise a great percentage increase. And then also, as I said before, we're looking at our general aid to weight certain kids higher and that would be kids from impoverished backgrounds and kids with students with disabilities and English learners, all three of those groups of students, which the Supreme Court actually called out several decades ago when they talked about this, that we have to make sure that those kids get that extra lift.
Any other particular areas of focus in this funding request, and especially in the funding increase?
Oh, absolutely. One is one in five of our kids have mental health issues, and that's clearly been a discussion in the media across the state of Wisconsin. We're proposing some additional resources for that, for teacher training and, frankly, community training around that particular issue, and also some money for resources for social workers and so on to help navigate the system to make sure those kids get the help they need. So that's really critical. I think that's something the governor's talked about in the past, the legislature's talked about in the past, and we're trying to amp that up, frankly. And then the last thing I'd like to listeners to think about is the whole issue of summer school. We believe that's an underused resource. We believe that summer school can be fun and kids can learn. They can avoid the summer slide that happens with kids falling behind. And there's various places in the state where we believe we can increase that and make a difference in kids' lives. Frankly, summer school should be treated just like regular school. School is school. We want it to be fun. We want it to be challenging for kids, and we're really trying to ramp up summer school also.
Now, some news just out. School report cards, not for the students, but for the schools themselves and districts, have come out. They've been in the news. I haven't broken down all the details. I understand these report cards are kind of a moving target because the standards have changed from year to year. That said, looking at what's come out, what do you make of them?
Well, overall, I think they're a good reflection of the success of our state. The majority of our schools and the majority of our school districts do a good job. I will say that we need to have a report card that is even more robust and more reflective of Wisconsin values than it is now. And we're limited by certain things, but I think it's a good first step, and it's something that is going to be a work in progress over the years. We have to make sure that things that we value at the high school level are really part of it. We have to make sure that our choice schools are involved in the system. Right now, we don't have enough data points to include them, and so it's going to be a growing process. And as it grows, it'll become a much better system.
As we wrap up, some Republican leaders in the state legislature have hinted that they might be open to some school funding increases. Are you optimistic that some or all of your requests might be met?
Well, I'm sure we'll have good. Not a lot, but some of the issues that we've proposed are in different proposals that we've seen from the assembly side, from the governor discussion, and so on. So I think we're going to find some common ground. And even if we don't find $700 million, at least we can have, I believe, starting out a robust discussion of how funding happens in our state. And I'm really looking forward to that. So I think it can be a very productive session.
Superintendent Evers, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Take care.
That's Tony Evers, Wisconsin State Superintendent of Public Instruction. He joined us today to talk about the budget proposal his department submitted to the Capitol for the upcoming state budget.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at how misleading or fake news spread on social media might have influenced the elections.
First, the U.S. Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, today issued a report on the drug crisis in America. Here he is describing the report's findings to NPR.
What may surprise people is to know that 20.8 million people in our country are living with a substance use disorder. This is actually similar to the number of people who have diabetes, and it's 1.5 times the number of people who have all cancers combined. That's pretty extraordinary in terms of the burden of disease that we have with substance use disorders.
According to that same report, there are now more people using prescription opioids than use tobacco. This epidemic is costing the U.S. more than $420 billion a year.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that 16,000 Americans die each year due to prescription opioid overdoses, and 3 out of every 4 heroin addicts first got hooked by taking prescription opioids.
In fact, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration says the vast majority of misused prescription drugs come not from drug dealers, but directly from doctors.
Dr. Anna Lemke joins us now. She's chief of addiction medicine and an assistant professor at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Her new book is Drug Dealer MD, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop. Dr. Lemke, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So this new report out today confirms something you already know. A lot of people are getting addicted, starting not with, you know, what you might think of illegal street drugs, but with these prescription pain-relieving medications.
Absolutely. It's really a national health care crisis.
Now, you deal with people with addictions every day, and you say the cause here goes back to, as you say in your title, how doctors were duped. How were doctors duped into prescribing, over-prescribing opioid pain relievers?
Well, a lot of times when people talk about this issue, they always blame big pharma. And there's no doubt that the pharmaceutical industry, motivated to get doctors to prescribe more opioids, had a part to play in this. But I think what's often forgotten is that it has always been the goal of the pharmaceutical industry to sell more drugs. The real interesting question is, why now? What changed in medicine that allowed Big Pharma to get such a toehold in there and get doctors to actually just start writing these prescriptions like mad? And the answer is twofold. Number one, there was a huge paradigm shift in medicine toward treating pain, which promoted more liberal prescribing of opioids for chronic pain conditions. Prior to 1980, doctors were reluctant to do that for fear of addiction. And the reason that that changed in medicine, because there was recognition that we weren't doing a very good job targeting pain in our patients. But the other reason that Big Pharma had such a toehold is because they were really exploiting the healthcare delivery crisis. More and more doctors have more and more pressure to see patients quickly, to see them in 5 minutes, to get them in and out the door, and to make sure that they're satisfied with their care. So in a way, prescribing more opioids was a solution not to patients' problems, but to doctors' problems, a way to make happy customers get in and out quickly.
Were there voices of doubt? Were there people warning, hey, we're going too far with these drugs as this epidemic was kind of happening under the radar?
The first people to really identify that the epidemic was happening were addiction medicine specialists. I started seeing this problem in my clinic very early on, and others in the field of addiction began crying out quite early, saying, hey, you know, I used to see people coming in with alcohol or various street drugs. Now I've got patients addicted to the medicine their doctor's prescribing without their doctor even realizing what's going on. But unfortunately, the voice of addiction medicine specialists has been really muted in the House of Medicine. For more than 200 years, addiction medicine physicians have been trying to advocate for the medical system to regard addiction as a medical illness, and there's been huge resistance to that. It's only recently that now medicine is starting to wake up and pay attention to the problem of addiction.
Yeah, in that CDC report that came out today, or the report that we heard from the U.S. Surgeon General, I should say, another point there was that with all these people with addictions, you know, maybe something like 1 in 10 of them has access, is getting some kind of treatment. Is that accurate as you see it?
Absolutely. And a lot of people, you know, have the misconception that people with addiction don't get treatment because they don't realize they have addiction. I have to tell you, I see so many people who come in here and say flat out, I have addiction, I want help, but my insurance company won't pay for it. You know, there are a lot of wonderful rehabilitation centers, residential treatment centers all around the country, tons of them in Southern California, but they cost upwards of $70,000 a month. Who can afford that kind of care? What we need to do is really reorganize medicine so that people can get their care within the House of Medicine and insurance companies will pay for it.
Do we know it works? Do we have effective ways to treat addiction?
Look, a lot of people say that addiction treatment doesn't work, but it's really not true. The data show that those who participate in addiction treatment have about a 50% response rate, and that's on par with the response rates for other chronic illnesses, from major depression to diabetes. So addiction treatment works, and there are a bunch of different strategies. There's medication-assisted treatment. There are psychosocial interventions. Even there are even the 12 steps, like Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous, can be very effective for those who actively participate, although it's not medical treatment per se. So a treatment works. The bigger problem here is getting insurance companies to pay for it.
Talking to Dr. Anna Lemke, author of Drug Dealer MD. She treats addiction. She works with a lot of patients. She's writing about how so many opioid medications got prescribed, how so many people got hooked on them. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. If this is a story affecting you, affecting your family or your community, 800-642-1234. Dr. Lemke, we talked a little bit about treatment there. Let's get to the prevention side. Are doctors starting to prescribe these opioid prescriptions less than they were?
Great question. So in CDC, in 2011, the CDC declared that we were in the midst of a prescription drug epidemic, and they clearly identified the major culprit, that is physicians overprescribing. You would have thought since that announcement, and since you cannot open a major paper or listen to mainstream media today without hearing about the opioid epidemic, that rates of prescribing would have gone way down, but it's not true. They slightly plateaued in 2013, but in 2014, we had record rates of prescribing of opioid analgesics in this country. So that really begs the question, why do docs keep prescribing? And the answer really is some major problems within our healthcare system. Again, incentives within the healthcare industry for doctors to prescribe even when they know it's not working.
And let's talk about when it's not working. You point out that there are appropriate uses of these medications. Chronic pain, chronic long-term pain, doesn't seem to be one of them. I learned this reading your book. For some patients, the opioid medication makes their chronic pain worse, not better. So they're addicted and still suffering from the pain.
Rob, that's a great point. I'm really glad you raised it. So we're not saying here that opioids don't work for pain. Opioids are like magical treatment for pain. The problem is that if you take them every day for an extended period of time, your body adapts to the effects and they eventually stop working. And then you have a new problem. Not only do you have your original pain, but you also have dependence and, if you stop taking them, withdrawal. And so this is really the important message that we have to get out to the public, that it's not that opioids are intrinsically bad. There's certainly a time and a place for them, but if you take them every day, you will develop tolerance, you will become dependent, and they can even change your pain threshold so that all of a sudden you start to be more sensitive to pain rather than less sensitive to pain. What we're experimenting now with and seeing good results is taking people off of chronic opioid therapy, which is a really hard thing to do because the withdrawal can be excruciating. But we're discovering that when we do that, their pain condition actually gets better than it was when they were on the high doses. So it's absolutely essential for people to understand this factor of the opioids. It's not that opioids are bad. It's not that opioids have no place in pain treatment. But when they're taken daily, they don't work for pain.
That's hard in the doctor's office, isn't it? I'm a patient. I'm feeling like I'm in pain. I need these medications. I'm a compassionate doctor. On the other side of this, I've got this patient who appears to have this real need. It's not just as easy as just saying no, is it?
No, it's really not. It requires a great deal of time to educate patients about this whole phenomenon of dependence, tolerance, and neuroadaptation. And one of the things that I always tell my patients is, you know, you take the pill and immediately it relieves your pain, but on some level, all it may be doing is relieving your withdrawal from your last dose, because part of opioid withdrawal is full body pain, even in patients who don't have chronic pain conditions. So this is a key point. People have this subjective sensation that taking the opioid relieves pain, but probably all it's doing after you've been taking it every day for months at a time is just relieving the withdrawal from the last dose.
Let's bring on a caller. Susan is with us in New Berlin. Susan, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call in this time. I used to work in dental offices, and in particular, one dentist that I was working for was prescribing like 20 to 28pills for a toothache that he took care of either that day or the next day. And I asked him if he could lower that dose. I said, you're taking him out of pain anyway. You know, please don't put that many more prescriptions, I mean, that many more pills out into the public. And he said, no, that's fine. So I talked to a pharmacist who was friends with him and said, you know, can you talk to him about lowering the number that he's giving out? And he said, oh, his prescriptions are about the same as every other dentist I work with. And I said, that's crazy. Then there are more dentists giving out all these meds.
And Susan, I want to jump in and give Dr. Lemke a chance to respond. Those patients who need it after a tooth extraction or a surgery, is this a big problem that they're getting too many of these pills when they walk out the door?
Well, first of all, Susan, I want to commend you for having the courage to speak up. It can be really hard to do that, so I really applaud you for doing that. In my book, I talk about a specific case of a young man who became addicted to opioids and eventually ended up on heroin, and it all started with a prescription from his dentist for Vicodin after a wisdom tooth removal. Why doctors do this, it's very complex and psychologically it's got all kinds of pieces of it. And again, I talk about it in my book, but basically what's going on there is a lack of awareness or understanding about addiction, wanting to have a grateful patient who thinks that they, you know, will do anything to treat their pain and that the opioids are okay. And also, frankly, not wanting to be called back and bothered with lots of, pain calls later for pain, just feeling like I'm going to give this big bottle and that way, you know, no one's going to call me back and I'll have more time for other things. So that's an oversimplification, but if you read my book, you'll be able to gain a better understanding of why basically good people and well-intended doctors and dentists might continue to engage in this behavior, even when it's not in the individual or the public's best interest.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Lemke, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Anna Lemke, Chief of Addiction Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Drug Dealer MD, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop.
Coming up, we'll talk about how misleading and even fake news could have played a role in the 2016 presidential election. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's True Stories Told Live on the Moth Radio Hour. In tonight's story, a woman decides whether she's a wig person or a scarf person while undergoing chemotherapy. A magazine editor is confronted by rapper Foxy Brown, and a mother navigates the everyday after her son is gravely injured. Tonight after 7, here on the Ideas Network.
First, it's been a little over a week since Donald Trump won the race for the White House. One issue that started emerging before the election but has come into sharper focus since Trump's victory on November 8th was what role social media may have played in the campaign.
And whether or not sites such as Facebook and Twitter helped spread false or misleading articles and information from often fake news sources.
Margot Suska joins us now. She's a professor of journalism and communication at American University. Margot, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, let's get clear on what we mean by fake news. What is it?
Well, fake news is exactly what it sounds like. It's a complete fabrication. Online, it may appear to look like a real news story with photos, even have a legitimate sounding URL and headlines, but it is completely and totally made up. And often, you know, we see user behavior, they'll click on a headline or share the story based just on a headline without any consideration whether or not it is or isn't fake.
I have to say, just researching to talk to you today, I saw a couple of examples of fake news that I'd come across on Twitter and just kind of went, wow, and kept thumbing down. Didn't bother to fact check it. But can you give us a couple of examples of some fake news stories that blew up during the election?
Sure. One that I saw that I was particularly taken in by was a photo of Yoko Ono, and it had the headline, "I had an affair with Hillary Clinton in the 1970s. Now, I don't want to legitimize the site that ran the quote-unquote story, but it has a very news organization-sounding name, and the first paragraph of the story said that Yoko Ono had shocked reporters when she'd revealed the news. You know, the other headline that I think garnered the most hits, fake headline, was that the Pope was supporting Donald Trump's presidential bid. And, you know, these are, you know, may seem to some people, you know, oh, of course those are fake, but these were widely circulated on social media online.
Now, the Washington Post today was running a story with one of these purveyors of fake news, a resident of Texas, who said he was doing it, you know, sort of more as parody and expected people to look at it, click, fact check it, and then for it to be, you know, to come out that this was a fake story, but he was surprised that didn't happen. So is that sort of the template for what happened with fake news?
Well, I saw the interview with Paul Horner that you're referencing, and I think that he was asked by the Washington Post if he somehow is responsible for Donald Trump's victory, because it was overwhelmingly conservative Republicans who shared the news. That's what the story suggested. I'm not sure that I believe Horner's claim that he thought people would fact-check every fake story that he put out. That's just not the news environment that we live in. And, you know, it's an issue really of both media literacy, but also an issue of time. You know, if you're looking at Twitter or Facebook, you have dozens of stories and headlines that you can click on. And the idea that somebody's going to see one and then somehow fact-check it further, you know, I just don't think that really, I don't think there's an understanding there of how we're using, you know, using social media sites to get our news.
On the other hand, though, the internet does kind of function as its own judge and jury a lot of the time. It will put out the erroneous fact or the fake news, and then someone will come along. You've got sites like Reddit or Snopes, and they'll say, no, this has been debunked. And so there are a group of peers crowdsourcing truth on the internet.
Well, I think that I certainly agree with you, and I think that what I am most encouraged by is that recently there have been a startup of fact-checking websites, and there are 100 fact-checking groups worldwide. And these are groups like PolitiFact, which is a Pulitzer Prize-winning group that checks information online. Three-quarters of those operate with a budget of $100,000 or less. So I think it's important to remember that, you know, there are people who are fact-checking or crowdsourcing these issues, but whether or not they're breaking through in the same way that Yoko Ono having an affair with Hillary Clinton with, you know, that bogus headline, whether or not these crowdsourced fact-checkers or even these legitimate fact-checking groups are breaking through the clutter in the same way that these wild headlines and clickbait headlines are, I'm just not sure. I don't see that as a possibility.
Is there any evidence that we have right now post-election that some of this fake news that went around during the election maybe helped swing the election one way or the other?
Well, I think that we're in the stages now where researchers are starting to look at beyond just anecdotally what happened. But there is anecdotal evidence that suggests that social media and social media shares have had an influence on people who use social media. So the Pew Research Center reported recently 20% of social media users changed their mind or stance on an issue after seeing a post. Now, let's remember, millions of posts are flying around, but more fake news stories generated hits than genuine news stories in the last critical months of the election. And I think that's really important to keep in mind. So whether or not it's cause and effect, I don't think that we'll be able to say that. Certainly we can't say it now, and more research is going to be needed. But the top 20 top performing fake news stories generated more than 8 million shares, reactions, and comments. And that's more than legitimate news stories, interactions on social media. And that's considerable. That's considerable when you put it with the Pew figure. I think that it's fair to say for some people, fake news had likely had a connection to how they voted.
We're talking to Margo Suska right now about the proliferation of misleading or fake news on social media sites like Facebook and Twitter. She's a professor of journalism and communication at American University. And again, looking at how this fake news could have had an impact on the election. And Margo, you talked about how these fake news stories got millions of hits. So how is it that a fake story could overtake something from a more established news outlet like in the New York Times?
Well, so this, I was just at a talk on Tuesday at the museum here in Washington, D.C., where this was a subject that came up. And really, if you're looking at a site like Facebook, which uses algorithms in order to prioritize what's in a person's news feed, now, those algorithms aren't public. Of course, Facebook's not going to share them, but they are putting fake news stories right next to legitimate news stories, the algorithms. So I think in that way, it's tough for a consumer to know if they're seeing a fake news story right next to a real news story, or if they're Googling something and the top search item that comes up is, you know, is a fake news story, but they've Googled it. You know, I think it's tough for people to understand how that happens, and that happens through the magic of Google and Facebook algorithms, which of course are secret. Now, what I'd like to think is that those algorithms are, of course, human constructions. And I think that we have to have a larger debate about what role Google and Facebook play in the debate about fake news.
And Facebook creator and founder Mark Zuckerberg weighed in on this. He was at a conference, last week's Techonomy conference, and was a little dubious about these claims that Facebook's algorithms had influenced the election. Here's what he had to say.
Voters make decisions based on their lived experience, right? I mean, one part of this that I think is important is we really believe in people, right? And that they can, like, you don't generally go wrong when you trust that people understand what they care about and what's important to them, and you build systems that reflect that. And, you know, part of what I think is going on here is people are trying to understand the result of the election. But I do think that there is a certain profound lack of empathy in asserting that the only reason why someone could have voted the way they did is because they saw some fake news, right? I think if you believe that, then I don't think you have internalized the message that Trump supporters are trying to send in this election.
Okay, an interesting response there from Facebook creator and founder Mark Zuckerberg. What do you make of that, Margo?
Well, I think it's interesting that he also said that identifying the truth is complicated. And I certainly take issue with that when it comes to knowing the difference between a fake news story and a real news story. And let's remember, Facebook has 1.7 billion users worldwide. So we're not just talking about fake news proliferating here in the United States, but all over the world. What we do know is that two-thirds of Facebook users access news on the social platform. So there is a real, this for many people, millions of Americans certainly, Facebook is their first place where they're going to go to get access to news and information. And I think that that means that Facebook has to have more of a responsibility in how information is getting out into a democratic society. Whether you support Clinton or a third-party candidate or Trump, I mean, in a democracy, we're supposed to have news and information that is true, that is fair, and we need that. And the idea that Zuckerberg could say, well, you know, I think we're, you know, giving too much weight to this, you know, I don't think he's really understanding, or at least isn't admitting, just how large Facebook's role is in disseminating news and information and culture in U.S. society.
Margo Suska is with us right now talking about the proliferation of fake news on social media sites like Facebook, like Twitter, and the impact it could have had on the election.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about fake news? Do you think it affected you or maybe someone you know? Have you shared a story that popped up on your feed and then realized on further review it was completely made up? Or have people shared such stories with you? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment. A real comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about the spread of fake news during the 2016 presidential election and the role that social media may have had.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you think social media sites like Facebook and Twitter had an impact on the election? And how are you more likely to read an article from a lesser-known website over news from, say, the New York Times? And do you get your news from social media sites like Facebook more than other places? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Margo Suska stays with us. She's professor of journalism and communication at American University.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Chris first in La Crosse. Chris, hi.
Hi. I'd like to get the guest's opinion on this. My thoughts are that Facebook is a forum for ideas, and whether those ideas are truth or fiction, I think their policy now is correct. They should be allowed to be shared on the same forum. However, Facebook does have a precedent for this, and that is celebrities. If you go to a celebrity's page, they'll have a check mark confirming that that is a real celebrity, that is the person. So maybe there's a system like that that can be put in place where websites have to register with Facebook and they get a check mark so when they're shared around that, they're legitimate.
Interesting, Chris. Thanks for that thought and suggestion. Margo, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it certainly is an interesting perspective in the same way that Twitter identifies legitimate news organizations or politicians, for example. Certainly that might be a role that they could play. I do like the caller's idea that Facebook is a forum for ideas, and I think maybe we need to have a deeper conversation or deeper conversations need to happen about whether or not those ideas should be misinformation or disinformation. I think these are conversations that we will have in the future. And I do think it's important to note, too, in terms of using fake news and using social media for news as a venue to get news, that this is happening at a time when trust in the mass media is at its lowest levels in four decades. So I think that there are problems not just in social media and fake news, but I think that there are real issues across the mass media, television, radio, and support and trust in these other news organizations. So it's not just social media, I think, right now that is having an identity crisis.
Well, thanks a lot for that call. And we're going to go next to John in Muscadet. John, hi.
Yes, the guests there just made my point exactly. I think part of the problem for this rests squarely on the shoulders of mass media. We could ABC, NBC, NPR, even Fox. We as the public sometimes don't know what to believe. I will listen to a speech right on beginning to end, whether it's Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, whoever, and then I'll listen to a news report about that same speech, and I was wondering if I'm even listening to the same speech because it seems to be so biased depending on what the media outlet is. And so therefore, us in the public feel like we need to go and find the news out for ourselves, and sometimes the sites that we're going to may not be any more accurate than the mass media. So I would like to see true accountability for the mass media and putting out there what's actually being said and the truth, as opposed to slanting it according to the political preference of whoever's reporting it. And I think that would solve a lot of the problem.
John, thank you for that. And he says the blame lies squarely on the shoulders of the conventional media, that there are these biases inherent in these mainstream news outlets and consumers sense this and they go somewhere else. And maybe that's not exactly on the up and up either. So how do you solve something like that, Margot?
Well, I think that there are a couple of interesting points here, and I think that it is a partly for many in the audience a media literacy issue, that with the partisan media really taking off for outlets like CNN and Fox News, and that is pundits that they have, I think it's tougher for Americans to understand who's hired to be an opinion person and who's hired to be a legitimate news person. And I also think it's important to note that there is research in something called the hostile media effect, which says that if there was an article with two positions and you agreed with one of those positions and disagreed with the other, by just seeing the position that you disagree with in the article, you automatically think that that news story is biased against your position. So I think that the issue of bias is an interesting one, and I think that certainly it's, I'm not saying that media isn't biased, but I think that sometimes the public's perception of it is it's tougher for the public to understand what they're seeing and what they're getting.
We're talking right now about the role of fake news in the election right now with Margot Seska from American University, and we'll take our next caller. Amanda's with us in Appleton. Amanda, hi.
Hi. I am an English teacher at the high school level, and a lot of what we do when we're doing research papers and trying to have kids find information is we definitely tell them there's a lot of bias out there. So I do believe there is some shared responsibility between people seeking information and those who are providing it. I think that media outlets that want to be reputable have a responsibility to make sure that they're kind of censoring the bias that is coming out. However, I think a lot of the responsibility should fall back on the people seeking information. We need to use more critical thinking skills. We need to cross-check our resources. And when we see something on Facebook that seems too good to be true or seems too outrageous, we need to follow up and check outside of Facebook to make sure those sources are correct, to be responsible people. And that all falls into media literacy, as I think was previously mentioned.
So, Amanda, you think it's the job of the media consumer, not so much, say, someone like Zuckerberg or Facebook or Twitter?
Right. I think we all should know that Facebook is kind of an open arena where anything goes, almost. So we have a responsibility. If we really want to know the truth, if we really want to know what's out there, we have to find that ourselves.
Amanda, thanks a lot for that. And Margot, do you think it's realistic to expect consumers of news to go do the digging, to take the time and trying to be savvy consumers and making sure what they're digesting is true and unbiased?
I think it's big. You know, we have a lot of responsibilities on our plate as Americans, let's face it, between work and family responsibilities. I think it's tougher now than ever to find the time to do what the caller suggested. But I absolutely agree with her that media literacy is a key component to understanding both mass media messages as well as, those included on social media as well. And I think part of what I talk to my college students about when we discuss this is, you know, a complete lack really of civics education anymore in the K-12 arena. And I think that that's a disappointment. We've seen in recent years such a strong emphasis on standardized testing, and I think partly social studies and civics have taken a back seat to that. And I think that this, what we're seeing now, perhaps media literacy, stems from civics not being as important as it used to be.
How do you think we should be teaching things like critical thinking and media literacy in school, in high school, elementary school, and beyond?
Well, I mean, I would love to see an understanding of what the media's role is in society. I know I have students who come here who don't really have an understanding of the watchdog press or the press as the fourth estate. And really the job of the press is to ask questions that other people won't ask of our government leaders and where our tax dollars are being spent. And oftentimes that's been framed lately, I think, as the media attacking a politician or the media being biased, when in fact they're really fulfilling the watchdog role that they should be as a fourth estate. So I'd like to see more of a discussion about what the role of the press is and what the role of politics is in society. And I think that, you know, in my work, I think that that would be very important.
And Margot, just literally a couple of seconds here, but do you think that the fake news that went around helped tilt the election one way or the other?
I guess I'm on the fence on that. I think that there were so many partisan sources of information and news going around this year, and it was such an ugly campaign, really, that I don't know that it was the reason that one person, that Trump won over Clinton. But I do think that it's troubling to consider how it could extend in the future.
Margot, thanks so much for joining us. That was Margot Suska, professor of journalism and communication at American University. She joined us to talk about the role that social media may have played in the spread of fake news during the 2016 presidential election. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.